Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned that the following podcast program may contain stories, names and voices of deceased persons.
This is Outback Out Loud.
People and stories from Outback New South Wales.
The most amazing little town there could ever be. I love it.
I left to come out west and I came out Jillaroo-ing at Warren. And from there, that's where I started my love affair again with the Western Plains, and I've never left Western Plains from there.
It's a great little spot to live.
You know, just everything about Louth I love.
Just home as far as I'm concerned.
Outback Out Loud!
That's what I like.
Welcome to Outback Out Loud.
In this season, we explore stories and life experiences from the most remote centres in New South Wales.
Let's hear more from historian Dr. Mary-Ann Jebb about Quambone.
Quambone Village was developed on land that was part of Quambone Pastoral Station. One of the pastoral runs taken up as European settlement spread west from the Castlereagh and Macquarie Rivers in the 1840s and 50s. In its early years, Quambone Station operated as a large grazing property, relying on sheep for wool production and cattle for meat, with Aboriginal families living in camps to provide labour. Only a few Europeans worked the pastoral leases in the early decades, as this station and other large holdings in the area relied heavily on Aboriginal workers to manage stock, waterholes, and work in the homesteads. Later, in the 1870s and 1880s, Chinese fencers and shepherds also worked local pastoral runs. Quambone Village was officially declared on the 28th of July 1894. During its early years, the village had a school, police station, three hotels, numerous shops, bakeries, blacksmiths, a cordial factory, a bank and several sawmills. When the rail line was built from Dubbo to Coonamble in 1903 to move wool, wheat and other produce from the Western Plains, it did not pass through Quambone, leaving the village a small road-linked village rather than a railhead. Aboriginal people remained an important part of the pastoral workforce into the 1960s, though many moved from the stations to live in camps or reserves outside the village. There are historically important buildings in Quambone, like the War Memorial Hall, which was originally built in 1912 as the Oddfellows Lodge and repurposed after World War I as a war memorial. Like much of the Western Plains region, large numbers of Quambone men enlisted at times of war, more than most other regions of Australia, partly because of the droughts and unemployment, and to play their part to protect Britain and Australian allies.
I'm Kathleen Smith, and we're in Quambone. I'm in Quambone General Store and Post Office, which my husband and I bought 13 years ago. We came here for a bit of a sea change coming from Perth suburbs, and we've got four children, and the youngest was 17 at the time, and we thought we'd make this big change and come over. Hubby was really interested in pursuing acting in Sydney. I had a bit of health issues and also a bit of a phobia of living in the city, so I really didn't want to live so close to suburbia, wanted to go a bit further out. So I was looking for a bargain of a house and a business to run, and we ended up a bit too far out. So you can imagine it's kind of a bit of a way out here. So Darius didn't get to do so much acting, but we had, it's kind of in between Brisbane and Melbourne here. We're pretty much kind of in between because of the Blue Mountains. It's pretty much similar distance to go either way. So we've done a couple of trips, but otherwise generally out here for the whole, most of the time, a couple of times we've had a break and had other people run it for us for a little while, but not going what it looks like right now, but at the height of it, we really had something that was really packed full of goods and was a thriving business for a while. But it's not easy having a business in a rural area. The locals are great, it's supporting, there's always going to be quiet times though, and it's also really, when it comes down to it, none of these little businesses really are, they're on the verge of micro to mini business at the best of times. It just is the way it is, you know. Anyone who's in hospitality knows that even with a big business, you're lucky to be able to break even and make any money. I'm from the Isle of Man, which is in the Irish Sea, and my oldest sister, who's 17 years older than me, she married an Australian, and who was on holidays. They were on the Guernsey Islands. They were studying and they met, and so she came out to Australia. So then it's the next 10-11 years my parents were trying to emigrate to Australia, so we came out four times, so my schooling was a bit mucked up. I went to 11 different schools, and then eventually we came out when I was definitely about 11-12, but still went back once more. They had businesses to finish up. So basically from 15, and I met Darius when I was, before I was 16, and we got married by the time I was 18. By the time I was 23, we had four children. There you go. So kind of, yeah, all quick. And then we both hadn't continued with education. So basically Darius had learnt how to do antique furniture restoration from my parents, who kept bringing containers out from England. And we had they had an antique shop which we lived in, and we worked in with them for quite a few years. And then Darius went out on his own, working from just from little adverts in the paper. And he worked for about 15 years doing that. Then he ventured off and did all kinds of building and maintenance and roof work, and then end up doing working in Perth City on different roofing, just basically as a handyman who fixes problems which other people wouldn't touch, and also doing like architrave inside of old homes and things where things weren't squared up, because with the working with antiques, of course, you know, you've got, it's individual kind of work. It's not just like a normal carpentry person wouldn't be able to go in and fix something that's not straight, and if they want something new that just kind of flat pack and go in. But if someone's got something, an older home, then Darius would be able to figure out how to, you know, doorways, and not just a handyman, but someone, a kind of craftsman as well. I mean, they'd come and give him a bag of bits and say, this is great grandma's rocking chair with rattan work, can you fix it? And he's there in the middle of, we had little babies around us, and he's making rattan seats, you know. All kinds of, you know, French polishing. It'd be something different every time, you know, we'd be doing. We came over, it was November 2012, and they just had another flood where the road had been cut off, and I thought, oh wow, this is exciting, living in such a remote place. I was pretty scared to even go on my own in the car to go to the shops, you know, 70 km. Like, what happens if I break down? I'll die, no one will come and save me. But so this found out very quickly that the community out here is wonderful, you know. Anyone would stop, even if you didn't like the other person, you'd stop and help them if they were broken down next to the road, and everyone just, you know, it's just part of living out here. They're very, very friendly. But yes, the building was pretty old, 100 years old, and hasn't had a lot of love and tender care for a few years. So it needed painting and that, needed, you know, a lot of cleaning up. And like I said, the Salvation Army came and helped, and that was pretty early on. They turned up and they came and said, it's the year of the farmer. We wanted to do something to help the farmers. And obviously the shop here is, you know, part of, you know, their whole community and that. And they said, what do you need doing? And I said, well, obviously we need to try and paint it and that. And yeah, and we, I think we had one of the uprights to the veranda was falling down, and a few different things. So yeah, so we got to paint eventually, and they came four times over a few years and helped us. And yeah, what it was like when we started, well, we basically had a lot of support from the locals again, and they were all happy. Started getting things in. We had that cool room there, and he had tiny little windows, so you couldn't really see what was in there. So we had other fridges in front that we used first of all, and it took a few years before we got these big, you know, the big kind of like, you know, supermarket glass doors with the argon gas and that in them, and the proper shelving and that. But yeah, and I mean, you can imagine the whole place here was full of stuff, you know, for quite a few years. We worked hard to fill it up. And well, we just obviously just tried to get it really set up like a normal thing people would expect. That took long enough because we didn't have any capital at all when we came. We had no money. So basically each week you're just sewing the money back in again. So basically everything you've ever earned, you're basically living here because the house is attached. And like a lot of people that have houses, you know, where they've got a business together, you can claim everything every time you get in the car. Well, you're going to buy something when you go out to town, so you can claim your fuel and, you know, your costs and that. But basically you survive, and you can't really pay yourself wages because you don't make enough, so you just kind of, you know, plod along. And if you need to buy presents for your kids over there, you're like, oh, can I pull a couple of $100 out? You just kind of, I just love living out here. It's just so beautiful. And it is isolated. And I think the worst thing was working 7 days a week. We did that first of all, long hours, 7 days, and then we eventually cut that down to eventually, over the years, it evolved to 9 to 5, and the weekend used to be 10 till 2. But obviously at the moment we're not open the weekends, so the shop's not properly going at the moment. But Well, I think when you're living in the city, you have this idea that it's scary coming out here because you just feel like a remote with the weather and things, that you could die. If your car broke down, you're going to die of being in 40-odd degree heat with no water, and the heat will get you and you'll just die. That was my idea. But when I got out here, it was just so different. And obviously, it's hot and uncomfortable for a little while there, but it's hot in Perth. It's the same. You get trapped in the suburbs and the air's not moving and you could die there the same. You know, so... No, it's just so different. It was like coming to another... I've always felt like I was going to Mars or something. I felt like I was going to another planet when I first got here. I mean, just out here specifically, more than the country, because now we're in the country of WA, we've moved. But here, you've just got all this beautiful kind of wildlife around you. And sometimes they come on the road or they're flying overhead and you know, you'll see, 100 eagles or hawks or white owls or deer or pigs or... The list goes on, you know. Like, we've got a family echidnas that live underneath the house, and I'm here on my own at night time hearing them all scratching around and moving around, you know, and then they wander through the pipeline and go to the guy across the road. There's just so much different wildlife, apart from all the bird life we get for the Macquarie Marshes, you know.
My name is Chris Andrews, and I am the admin manager at Quambone Public School. I... grew up in down south at a little place called Kuruwatha. Was there from 5 to 15. And then we moved to just outside of Cowra. And then I got a Jillaroo job up here near Canamble. It's just farm work. It's basically farmhand, just female farmhands. Like these days... there's not that many Jillaroos around this area, but there's a lot up in Queensland still on the big cattle paces and whatnot. But you just do general stock work. You can either, depending on the farm you're on, either do work with sheep or cattle, mustering and looking after their health. Or if you're on a farming place, you learn to drive tractors and do different things like that. And then I met my husband and I'm still here. We've been married 40 years this year. So, yeah, we came to Quambone for a tennis weekend, tennis day, fun day, up here at the tennis courts. And then he happened to come in and I would meet him there. And then Quambone used to have gymkhanas, fun family fun day, gymkhanas, horse events, you know, kids jumping and bending and camp drafting and things like that. And we met up there one day and, yeah. Started from there, and then we both played polo cross. They kept sort of our paths kept crossing, so yeah, still are. The property we're on, it was a soldier settler's block. Been in the family for over 100 years. Beef cattle and grain cropping, wheat and chickpeas in this year, and we're on the edge of the Macquarie Marshes, so we get flooded. Beneficial flooding every now and then through. We've actually got flood water come through now at the moment. Because down this end, we're all basically graziers and you just get flooded country, like on the edge of the marshes. Water comes in, spreads out, and then your cattle, your stock can go back in onto the flooded country, you know, grass graze and all the rest of it. And the irrigators, some of them think that's a waste of water. They think they can get more use, make more money out of their water with their crops and things. There's a lot of kerfuffle on at the moment about the water and the how much water is released from the dam for farmers, for domestic stock and domestic, and Macquarie Marshes. And the irrigators don't think they need it, don't think it's warranted in a lot of cases. I know the irrigators, they're allowed entitled to water too. Everyone's going to make a living. But I don't think they should be allowed to take all the water off a natural environment just because they don't think it's worthwhile doesn't mean it isn't. And the birds and things, the water birds that are nearly extinct, at some come and nest there. And we've got, we've had frog surveys, people coming out from universities on our place doing frog surveys and seeing what sorts of frogs and things are around in the wetlands and that. It's all quite interesting once you get into it and people explain it to you. Just like in your own little nature world. It's just best, I think it's the best place to raise kids. They're out, they get a better understanding of how everything works, how the animals, where your food comes from and everything like that. And I think it makes them very much more tolerant of different things, things that you can't control. Like Mother Nature's can be very, very unforgiving at times, and there's nothing we can do about it. You just got to deal with it. I think it's a great place to bring kids up. Where we are, it's been interesting, like, because with the flood water that we get through, but like in 22, when the big flood came through, where our house is, there's a water course between us and the main road out. And I was driving, I had our car on at our daughter's house, which is on this side of the water. So I was driving a buggy down to the water's edge, and then I get in a canoe and paddle across this water course, get in the car and come to work. And then just different, you know, you do different things like that. You just don't get to do that sort of thing in a lot of places. It was nearly 12 months before I got my car back to the house with that water that was there. But that was interesting. But yeah, I just enjoy the peace and quiet of where I live.
While we're at the school, we caught up with the students.
What's your favourite animal and why?
Roos, because they have baby jellies and they're cute.
Why do I like fishing? Because you can go places where you've never seen and you can catch fish. And yappy sometimes.
Why do you like riding horses?
Because I can do barrel racing and if you go to a show, rodeo, then you can win money. Ride in different saddles and feel the different technique in the saddles, because the dressage saddles are looser and western saddles are like tighter together.
What's your favourite savoury food?
Chinese. My favourite thing is Mongolian lamb. What? That's the best. My favourite thing at school is maths, because it's really fun. And because all my brothers are good at maths, everybody in my family, their favourite thing has been maths, and mine has been.
What would your favourite part of the environment in New South Wales be?
Probably like our Macquarie Marshes or our national park, the Warrumbungles.
I like spending time with my family and help mum. Like making pens so that she can sell them. She prints. She makes shirts and I help design shirts. And she makes phone cases that I made a design of.
What's your favourite food?
Lasagna. Because it's good and you can make it however you want.
Why do you like fishing so much?
Because you can see nature and you can see beautiful fish.
What's your favourite dog and why?
Bossy is from... She's cute. Even she has puffed up cheeks, even she's a good peeing dog.
What is your favourite food?
Probably shrimp fried rice, because I like the taste of shrimp and I like the rice's unique flavour.
Why do you like drawing so much?
Because you get to feel the different techniques and you can express yourself with your drawings.
What is one of the things that you love to do that I know you were really looking forward to when you went out to the Guduga Games?
Oh. Dancing to the Macarena.
The disco.
Lane and me, we always wanted that song on.
What's your favourite food?
Apple.
Why?
Because they have very good juice.
Any type of apple? Do you like red apples, green apples?
Definitely red.
Thank you guys for listening.
Well, my name's Margaret Garnsey and I'm a resident of Quambone. I was born in Gilgandra, but we only stayed in Gilgandra till I was about two. My older brother, I have two brothers, one older, one younger. My older brother had asthma. Mind you, I was way too young to know. And my parents were told that they had to move to a cold climate and get him out of the dust, and particularly the wheat dust. Or the other alternative was that he'd have to go away to boarding school from age five and only come home in the May school holidays, so for 2 weeks of a year. So our family was relocated to O'Connell, which is between Bathurst and Oberon. And they said a cold climate was a good spot to relocate to, but they didn't tell us that we had to relocate to a freezing, freezing hole. I don't think I defrosted from then till I left home. But did years 7 to 12 at Bathurst High. And then as soon as I finished high school, I left to come out west. And I came out Gillarooing at Warren. And from there, that's where I started my love affair again with the Western Plains, and I've never left Western Plains from there. I just packed up the car that I'd bought with my savings from school, put everything that I owned in the car, drove out. I had applied through the land and had a position at Warren. So I used to help a man. He was basically a caretaker of five or six different properties, and I would assist him, and we did all the maintenance, like the waters, the dogs, the chooks for absentee owners, water the gardens. Then there was times when we'd be mustering and we'd bring in sheep or cattle, depending on what husbandry things used to be done. But we didn't do any of the really big jobs. We did mostly just the smaller jobs and the maintenance jobs. I did that for several years, quite liked it. I've always ridden horses, so I was very keen. I got my horses up from Bathurst, and I was already playing polycross, so I linked in with the people around Warren that were playing polycross. So I used to enjoy being able to go out and being told that you've got to go and check those sheep, because I'd go out on my horse and do it. I used to always have a fair bit of fun like that, and then we'd play polycross on the weekends. And it was a very good way to meet people, and it was a great community, and I'm still involved with polycross. But yeah, eventually I got married young, and then we actually were on Raby Merino stud. So I spent quite a few years on Raby Merino stud with my husband, and then we moved to Quambone, and he had a position as a manager at on a Quambone property, but that's when that relationship was terminated. And I moved on from husband number one to husband number two, who is a Quambone resident and also plays polycross. I'd known him since I was about 16, because all the Western clubs, all the players know each other. So that's when I eventually formed a relationship with Larry. I already had four children, and I added two more children with Larry. So we've risen six boys. So he was stepfather to four, and we added two. But none of the boys were very old when I moved into with Larry to start with, so it was all a bit full on. But yes, I've been in Quambone now for 35 years. I don't know what it'd be like to raise children anywhere else. It just seemed to be an extension of your own childhood. They all rode. We had heaps of horses. They all played polycross. They were always taken to lots of sports, cricket mostly. There wasn't a lot of football available. And in the winter, we mostly played polycross anyway. So we all played polycross, which included Larry. So that gave us a family sport that we played. So Friday nights, you'd pack up the truck and head on out and get back Sunday night, unpack the truck and shove kids into bed and pull them out in the morning to go to school. There's six players in the team, and you're split into two sections of three. So only three of your players and three of the other team's players are on the field at any one time. You have three positions: attack, centre and defence. We just call them number one, number two and number three. The field is divided into three sections as well: an attack area, a centre area and defence area. And you have a racket, which is like a long squash racket, but the net's soft and our ball is soft. It's about 4 inches round. So if I threw the ball at you and it hit you, it might sting, but it won't do anything more than that. Well, if you really pelted it, it probably could, but, you know, like it's a soft, good soft ball. Doesn't hurt your horse, doesn't hurt you. And you pick it up and you throw it to your players. You can't carry a ball from the centre to attack. You have to, over the line, you have to pass it in. And then your attack player only has a defence person on them and they work the area and try and throw a goal. And then at the end of the chucker, your three come off and your other three go on, and you only have one horse per player. That's why it's called poor man's polo, because you only have one horse for each rider. And that's why family can play, because polo, you have four horses for one player, so that would be enormous. Like, we had six boys, so there's no way in the world you'd have to have a semi-trailer to take all your horses. So, because the kids all use their horses for on-farm. We did have quad bikes, but... like when they were younger, we certainly just sent them all out in horses to get this paddock in or muster. So you use the horses. So it was an extension of what you were doing on farm, and it gave you a social opportunity, and for us, a family opportunity, to play sport with your children. Yeah, still enjoy it. I am the first councillor from Quamain to go onto council since the ridings were dissolved. Years ago we had riding, you had ridings across the shire, and your area, you had, which was your riding, you had to elect a councillor from that spot. So that meant someone from Quamain was always on the council, someone from Galar was always on the council. And across your shire you had evenly spread, so people across the whole shire had representation. So they took that out about 25 years ago, and at least for the last 20 years or more, it's basically only been Coonamble people that get enough votes to actually be on council. And people didn't think that through, and they didn't think that would be particularly negative. When I was running for Shire and we did the pre-polling in Coonamble, lots of people would say to me, I was quite surprised. They said, what are you doing here running for our Shire? I said, first of all, I was flabbergasted, and I said, well, you know, we live in your Shire. No, you don't. Yes, I do. I live in Quamain. Many people said, that's not in our shire. But after a week and a bit, I'd become quite frustrated with that. And I said, well, I am in your shire. We pay rates. And Quamain deserves to be represented. I got a little bit more harsh by then. Things that need to be initiated is there's definitely streets here that need to be tarred. They've not done anything really large in Quamain for years. The drainage system in the whole village is terrible. It blocks up as soon as we get heavy storms, and the fellows that are trying to keep the water draining have a lot of trouble. The village has so much rubbish in it, so many blocks that have not been tidied up. We've got a block up here with 800 and something odd tyres. It's a huge fire risk. 7 years we've been lobbying for the Shire to clean that up, and hopefully they're getting onto that now. Another serious issue in town is no one's even been ever allocated a proper street number, address. So you have three or four people that might say they're in 10 Tucker Tucker Street, because they're on the map, they're on lot 10, but lot 10 is bigger than their house blocks. You don't think that's a big issue until you ring an ambulance. Ambulances now all go to Google Maps, and no one can find an address in Quamain, because there's no grid-worked address system that can pinpoint to Tucker Tucker Street or 10 Mungi Mungi Street. So they drive around here totally lost. Years ago, you had people in Coonamble that knew the village of Quamain, and they would, I know where Frank Burns lives, I know where Larry Garnsey lives, and they didn't even need an address. Now we have young ones, which is good, I don't mind having young ones, but we have people who have no idea of our village. And they shouldn't have to be knocking on someone else's door saying, where does Emma live? We're trying to get to her. Where's Emma? You know? And that's what's happening at the moment. Nobody knows where anyone lives because we have no proper addressing. So that's another big, that's a big issue that I've got to start to push through. Oh, I think they get sick of me.
Squeaky wheels, though.
Yes, it is. I just said to Lara this morning on another issue altogether, squeaky gate gets the oil, I said.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just... It is as gorgeous countryside It can be extremely hard when we're in drought. It's mortifyingly hard when we're in drought. But we've always had a very strong community. People have got together here many times. In fact, the strongest our community has been at the worst times of our droughts. That's when people really come together.
Thanks for listening. To hear more amazing stories from Outback New South Wales, check out the whole Outback Out Loud series, now streaming everywhere.
We acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and work, and whose cultures are among the oldest continuing cultures in human history.
Please like, subscribe, rate us, and write a review. The Outback Out Loud podcast was designed and produced by Signal Creative. Season 4 of Outback Out Loud has been made by Outback Arts. You can find Outback Arts at outbackarts.com.au or on Facebook and Instagram. This season was made possible with funding support from the Regional Arts Fund. On-ground support this season came from Marnie Vaughan and Andrew Hull. Outback Out Loud Season 4 was researched, consulted, recorded, and edited by Emma Hoy. Thank you to everyone who's been involved over the last 5 years.